The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Chapter 7. The Need for Socialist Organization. Organization is necessary in any struggle, for the simple reason that no social or economic change can be achieved without some group of people coming together and demanding it. If you want better wages, you must organize along with your fellow workers. If you want a government to rescind a budget cut or grant a social reform, you must organize in the workplaces and in the streets. All struggles throughout history have involved at least a rudimentary form of organization. In that sense, there is no such thing as pure spontaneity. Spontaneity, therefore, is a matter of degree. On the extreme end of spontaneity are struggles involving a high degree of improvisation by people without prior experience of struggle and organization. As the late British socialist Duncan Hallis wrote, quote, "Spontaneity is a fact, but what does it mean? Simply that groups of workers who are not accustomed with active with any political or even trade union organization take action on their own behalf or in support of others. From the point of view of organizations, the action is spontaneous. From the point of view of the workers, it is concerned, conscious, and deliberate." End quote. The question for socialists today is how to bridge the gap between muted anger and collective action, and between collective action and socialist consciousness. To again quote Hallis, quote, "Spontaneity and organization are not alternatives. They are different aspects of the process by which increasing numbers of workers can become conscious of the reality of their situation and of their power to change it. The growth of that process depends on a dialogue, on organized militants who listen as well as argue, and who are able to find connections between the actual consciousness of their fellows and the politics necessary to realize the aspirations buried in that consciousness." End quote. The most obvious case for organization is that the other side is organized. The ruling class has its civic and economic organizations, its research institutes, its elite universities, its think tanks, and its exclusive clubs. It also has the resources of the state behind it. The working class does not have any of these advantages. It has numbers, but numbers mean nothing if they are not organized into a real force. Unions are a step forward, but as we've seen, they fight the effects of capitalism, and not capitalism itself. The working class, to achieve socialism, must build an organization of socialist militants. Marx and Engels laid out the general approach in the Communist Manifesto. The communists, they argued, were distinguished from other working class parties in the following way. Quote, 1. In the national struggles of the proletarians of the different countries, they point out and bring to the front the common interests of the entire proletariat, independently of all nationality. 2. In the various stages of development which the struggle of the working class against the bourgeoisie has to pass through, they always and everywhere represent the interests of the movement as a whole. The communists, therefore, are on the one hand practically the most advanced and resolute section of the working class parties of every country, that section which pushes forward all others. On the other hand, theoretically, they have over the great mass of the proletariat the advantage of clearly understanding the lines of march, the conditions, and the ultimate general results of the proletarian movement. End quote. This concept of organization sees socialists neither as mere participants in the struggle, nor as an elite that dictates to the masses, but as comrades in struggle who, in participating in today's movements, try to move the struggle as far as it can go, introducing to wider layers of workers the need for the socialist alternative along the way. The Workers' Party acts not only to disseminate socialist ideas, but is involved directly in every struggle. Moreover, it doesn't offer utopian descriptions of the socialist future, but rather gathers together and distills the most important historical lessons of past struggles, in order that those experiences can provide lessons for future struggles. The German socialists, even before Engels' death in 1895, were beginning to diverge from this concept of organization as a result of their great electoral successes. In 1887, writes a historian of German socialism, social democracy polled 10.1% of the vote in the Reichstag elections. In 1890, 19.7%. 1893, 23.3%. In 1898, 27.2%. And in 1903, 31.7%. Is it to be wondered that social democracy became attached to its tried and true tactic? End quote. This tremendous electoral success led its trade union and parliamentary leaders to see the party not as embracing only the most advanced and resolute, but as appealing to all workers, radical or otherwise, and even to middle-class voters. This slow accumulation of supporters, through playing to the lowest common denominator of consciousness, was the way to win elections, not through fiery radicalism. Marx's conception was also different from its Stalin caricature, which saw the party not as a revolutionary part of the class, but as a bureaucratic elite standing over the class and dictating to it. This all-seeing, all-knowing monolith was an invention of Stalinist hacks. The Russian socialist movement, in particular the Bolshevik Party, put into practice and refined what were only rudimentary guidelines in the manifesto. Western anti-communists who attack Lenin and the Bolsheviks read the later bureaucratic distortions of Stalinism back into the history of the Russian revolutionary movement, presenting the Bolsheviks as a top-down, highly militarized sect. According to R.N. Carew Hunt, author of a standard Cold War assessment of communism, Lenin favored building a, quote, small and highly disciplined organization that would, quote, exercise control over the revolutionary movement. Quote, tutelage by an intellectual elite of professional revolutionaries, wrote Lenin biographer David Shub, was a hallmark of Leninism. Shub claimed that Lenin's conception of, quote, democratic centralism was a movement organized along lines of military hierarchy and discipline. These views are repeated in Stalinist literature. The only difference is that the alleged monolithic, infallible, and dictatorial character of the Bolshevik Party is presented positively. These assertions require historians to ignore the facts that the party membership consisted of mostly young workers who were leading activists in their workplaces, that the internal life of the party was filled with sharp debate and disagreement, and that its decisions were made, wherever conditions permitted, with the fullest democracy. Ignored are statements by Lenin such as the following. Quote, the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party is organized on democratic lines, This means that all the affairs of the party are conducted, either directly or through representatives, by all the members of the party, all of whom, without exception, have equal rights. Moreover, all officials, all leading bodies, and all institutions of the party are subject to election, are responsible to their constituents, and are subject to recall. End quote. The dreaded phrase, democratic centralism, was one whose meaning should be clear to anyone in any democratically run activist organization that is attempting to implement a decision. First debate, then vote, and then act in unison to put that decision into effect. Why is democracy in the movement necessary? Because, as Lenin explained, the success of mass action requires the conscious and voluntary participation of every individual worker in the debate. A strike, for example, cannot be conducted with the necessary solidarity unless every worker consciously and voluntarily decides for himself the question, to strike or not to strike. Lenin insisted that firm and intelligent decisions, not those based on clannishness, friendship, or force of habit, could be made only on the basis of open debate and discussion. But socialist organizations are not talk shops that value discussion for its own sake, as do academics. Once debate is had, a decision must be made that the collective is disciplined enough to act on. That is the centralism part of democratic centralism. For the real Lenin, not the Stalinist caricature, leadership had to be won in the struggle, proven, not declared. The much maligned term vanguard for Lenin merely meant what Marx meant in the Communist Manifesto by the most advanced and resolute section of the working class. Lenin argued that such an organization was necessary because there were, quote, different degrees of consciousness and degree of activity inside the working class. In periods of retreat, when struggle was at a low ebb, only a small minority of workers actively embraced socialism. But in periods of mass upheaval, ever larger sections of the class moved in a socialist direction. Each fresh wave of radicalization would bring new forces to the movement, but only if there was an organization fighting alongside them to bring them along. To forget the distinction between the vanguard and the whole of the masses gravitating towards it, to forget the vanguard's constant duty of raising ever wider sections to its own advanced level, Lenin wrote, means simply to deceive oneself, to shut one's eyes to the immensity of our tasks, and to narrow down these tasks. This vanguard was not a thing standing apart from the class, but the gathering together of anti-capitalist militants into a single fighting organization. Such an organization isn't like a foreman on the job or a teacher in a classroom. It is a comrade in the struggle, both learning from and guiding the movement. Quote, the communists fight for the attainment of the immediate aims, for the enforcement of the momentary interests of the working class, summarized Marx and Engels in the manifesto. But in the movement of the present, they also represent and take care of the future of that movement. A socialist revolutionary must be different from the sectarian who stands outside the struggle, criticizing its inadequacies. The extreme leftist who tries to jump so far ahead that he or she is cut off from the real movement. Or the activist who is content with participating in the struggle, without challenging it to accomplish more. A a mass party or organization that merely participates in struggle, adapts to its existing conditions, and cannot lead it beyond its present limits. But a sect that abstains from a struggle because it isn't radical enough is simply irrelevant. The type of organization socialists would strive to build was described perfectly by the late British socialist Duncan Hall in 1871. Quote, "The many partial and localized struggles on wages, conditions, housing, rents, education, health, and so on have to be coordinated and unified into a coherent forward movement based on a strategy for the transformation of society. In human terms, an organized layer of thousands of workers, by hand and by brain, firmly rooted amongst their fellow workers, and with a shared consciousness of the necessity for socialism and the way to achieve it, has to be created." End quote. Every mass movement gives rise to debates about the way forward. The trade union officialdom, the old reformist leaders, and liberal organizations step to the fore and attempt to corral the movement, to lead it, and to contain it. In such a situation, a distinction needs always to be made between the reformism of the masses being drawn into activism for the first time, ordinary people who do not yet believe they have the power to run society, and therefore look to better rulers than the old ones, as opposed to more entrenched political forces that are consciously committed to reforming but not dismantling capitalism. In every revolutionary movement, the need for an organization of revolutionaries that can fight inside the movement to break past the constraints of reformism and win the majority of workers to the idea that they must pose a new alternative to capitalism becomes pressing. The possibility that workers might be able to translate their power into more than just opposition to the way things are is not at first apparent to most of them. It becomes so only through a period of hard lessons in the course of struggle. In the process of struggle, ideas of solidarity, equality, and opposition to oppression come to the fore. But workers don't become aware of their position and power in society at the same time. Some move faster than others and are ready to take the lead. The role of revolutionary organization is to unite the most militant workers and activists in the struggle, those who have a clear grasp of the possibilities for revolutionary change, so as to be able to turn revolutionary potential into reality. In periods of mass struggles, the barrier between economic and political struggle breaks down. Workers who not long before believed they had no power suddenly find themselves engaging in mass action, finding confidence and demanding respect. Every manifestation of injustice becomes a target of action. Each struggle inspires the next, and no issue or grievance is beyond action. For example, a strike wave in the summer of 1981 in Poland, during the heyday of Solidarnosc, involved a strike by airline workers demanding the right to choose their own manager, a dock strike to stop the export of food, people were starving in Poland at the time, a protest by newspaper print shop workers against anti-Solidarnosc propaganda on the news, a strike of transport workers against corruption, a strike of workers in one town demanding that those responsible for repression against an earlier strike movement be fired, and hunger marches by thousands of women demanding food. In a mass upsurge of struggle, an increasing number of militants begin to grasp the possibility that the movement, if it is to move forward, must seize power. Things must go either forward or backward, but can't stagnate. If these militants are not organized and united around a common campaign to win over the rest of the class to a program of revolutionary action, their sentiments, ideas, and partial insights will dissipate without real effect. Reformist leaders will retain dominance in the movement, and, in the name of unity and realism, will encourage the working class to curb its enthusiasm. In Poland, many of the leaders of Solidarnosc, such as Lech Walesa, accepted the idea of a, quote, self-limiting revolution. Though many militants were aware of the fact that Solidarnosc, a mass movement of almost 10 million workers that sprang from mass strikes, had the potential to be far more than a trade union fighting for reforms, there was no organized or coherent attempt to challenge its leaders from the left. The fact that the Polish state capitalist regime had claimed the mantle of socialism and had appropriated phrases like class struggle did not help. The working class was reinventing workers' power against a ruling class that had appropriated their traditional symbols in terms of revolt. But this experience highlights the key role a genuine socialist organization of militants could have played in Poland at the time. Solidarnosc's self-limitation, writes Colin Barker in his account, was a disastrous strategy. Time and time again, the leaders of Solidarnosc found themselves urging their members not to, quote, go too far, not to frighten the authorities. Time and time again, they reined the movement in, rather than encouraging it forward. Their members' militancy was a problem for them, rather than the key to a solution. End quote. The alternative was a revolutionary strategy aimed at seizing control of workplaces, winning over the rank and file of the armed forces, and replacing the bureaucratic state apparatus with workers' democracy. Only a strong organization united around such a program could have even posed this alternative as a possibility in Poland. Sadly, none existed. In Chile in 1973, the revolutionary process had advanced considerably further than in Poland in 1980. Left-wing militants in the Socialist Party, sharply critical of the party's right wing, and of the Communist Party that claimed Chilean socialism could come through a series of peaceful compromises, demanded that the party adhere to its commitment on paper that, quote, only by destroying the bureaucratic and military apparatus of the bourgeois state can the socialist revolution be consolidated. But these militants never organized independently or coordinated their efforts nationally, and therefore were incapable of providing an alternative leadership to Allende's popular unity government. As a result, their left-wing rhetoric merely convinced the working class to stick with popular unity, even as the latter moved further and further to the right. Without a revolutionary party, the revolutionary moment is lost, and the movement either goes into decline or is defeated. Either way, society begins to flow back into its old channels, and order is restored once again. Without a guiding organization, the energy of the masses would dissipate like steam not enclosed in a piston box, wrote Trotsky. But nevertheless, what moves things is not the piston or the box, but the steam. End of section.